Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, October 24th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly roundup of news media performance from the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab. Across the table, our Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On our program this week, horses and bayonets dominated social media reaction to this week's third and final presidential debate. Meanwhile, debate moderator Bob Schieffer kept the candidates on time, if not always on topic, and he joined the long list of journalists to say Obama when he meant Osama. President Obama denied during the debate a New York Times story that the Iranians and the White House have agreed to one-on-one negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. But he also chided Mitt Romney during the debate about supporting those negotiations. The BBC is in turmoil over an alleged cover-up of sexual harassment by one of its longtime presenters. Is this the Biebs phone hacking scandal? Newsweek magazine shuts down the printing presses at the end of the year. What lessons can other magazines and newspapers draw from this digital-only decision? Apple announced its iPad mini yesterday, timed to coincide with Friday's launch of the Microsoft Surface. Will the folks who brought us Windows offer real competition for the tablet that Steve Jobs built? And will it matter to journalists and media companies? Both President Obama and Mitt Romney made a few media-related jokes at last week's Al Smith charity dinner in New York, though the GOP nominee's needling was certainly sharper and maybe funnier. And you know the troubles of mainstream journalism have reached critical mass when even Superman no longer wants to work for the Daily Planet. But first, let's get back to the debate. Several memes emerged from the foreign policy tussle between the president and Mitt Romney. Perhaps the least interesting one was the question of who won. But did Romney flip-flop? Was Barack Obama the aggressor because he's fallen behind? How well did Bob Schieffer stack up against the three previous moderators? Why did the president deny a New York Times exclusive on negotiations with Iran? Well, we'll get to all those questions in a moment, but the moment of the debate, if you want to believe Twitter at least, and as well a whole host of pundits, was this Romney put down by an obviously well-prepared president.
I think Governor Romney maybe hasn't spent enough time looking at how our military works. You mentioned the Navy, for example, and that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed. We have these things called aircraft carriers where planes land on them. We have these ships that go underwater, nuclear submarines. And so the question is not a game of battleship where we're counting ships. It's what are our capabilities?
Well, the first debate had Big Bird. The second one had binders full of women. Well, now, Lee, we have horses and bayonets. Why this sort of snarky focus of the social media, and are we making too much of it?
I think we're making too much of it. The snarky focus is this one is easy. It was easy to capture in 144 characters. It's one of those things that it says more deep down than is on the surface. I think the implied critique, actually not very implied, the critique is you need to think about the military differently and not simply count. And here you can insert almost anything, not just ships, number of troops, kinds of weapons, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And whether or not you accepted that critique, I suspect depends on who you supported going into the debate. But it certainly was a legitimate way and a very pointed way to make it.
Charles, I mean, I thought it was interesting sort of the attempt to counter this after the debate. I mean, I don't know that Romney had much he could say about it other than to point out what he was really saying about military preparedness. But on the right, you had all these folks coming out saying, oh, he's going to be hurt in Virginia with the Navy and all those bases that are there. And the president just looked like he was being mean and snarly. So can you really fight humor that way?
Not really. And I think the thing that the president and probably the president's advisors have done really well is come up with one pithy statement for every debate, which I think Obama goes into the debate fully stockpiled with three or four of them, and they pick a meme, and they literally can see the Facebook meme emerging as he says it. And whether or not that has any traction electorally is anybody's question, right? I mean, it's good fun on the front end, and we certainly get a chuckle when we read our Facebook feed, for example. Whether that does anything electorally, we'll have to find out.
I mean, clearly, this is what most people would agree is the first true Twitter presidential election, and we will have to see what the data shows us. But I have to ask, and maybe I'll ask it in a larger sense, Lee, does all of this focus on whether it's Big Bird or binders full of women or horses and bayonets, or for that matter, the debates themselves ultimately matter much this year in terms of what the final outcome will be? I mean, what can we say about that?
What we can say is I think the voters in many cases have not yet gone to the polls. I don't know that we know definitively. I certainly think that the debates, particularly the first debate, has done a great deal to bolster the Romney candidacy and certainly the Romney supporters. It's less clear to me that the last two have had the same impact on President Obama's candidacy, but it's at least possible. The sort of question that's lodged all in this is, if you spent your time tweeting, does that make you more or less likely to go to the polls? Does it make you more or less likely to vote on certain issues and to discount others? I don't think we have those answers yet.
Let's focus on some of the other media memes that came out of this last debate especially. And I guess one is we get every time is, who won? And I think everybody, Charles, would say at the very least the president won on points, which seems to be the new mantra. But also the meme was, it doesn't seem that it matters. The instant polls didn't seem to suggest that it was going to matter that much. So why do we even talk about who won these debates?
I've always wondered that myself. I'd much rather talk about the substance of the debate itself. And actually, if you look at – I've been reading a lot of journalism – after the debate, and I think a lot of it was quite good because a lot of it didn't really focus on who won the debate and instead have focused on the substantive policy positions that were discussed during the debate. And that's kind of what I would hope would happen every time. It doesn't, but it's what I would hope would happen. Now, contrast that with the discussion of the race itself and this ludicrous, myopic focus on the popular vote at the exclusion of how presidents are actually elected. And I'm left day after day just sort of stupefied by the coverage and its complete focus on the popular vote.
Well, so you also had, Lee, a journalist trying to discern what was in the minds of the candidates, what their strategies were. The president was, quote, on attack because he's coming from behind. Romney was trying to be dull, didn't even say anything about Benghazi because he was moving to the center and he wanted to hug the president rather than fight him. What do you make of those?
I don't make much of those because, quite frankly, I don't think anybody can crawl into anybody else's brain at this point in a political campaign. There may be some good post hoc analysis, but not right now. The journalism that I saw that I thought was good, and some of it started almost immediately after the debate, was journalists saying, well, this is what Governor Romney said during the debate about X, because there were many places where you could do this. And this is what he said a week ago or 2 weeks ago or during the primaries. And there was a lot of that attempt to, I don't want to say in real time fact check, because I'm not sure that this is fact checking so much as this is a comparison of what happens to your stances when you feel compelled to move towards the middle. And one thing we've known about American presidential elections is they're always a race for the middle. It's been that way since after World War II.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, Charles. I mean, there seems to be almost apoplexy on the part of some pundits and even reporters on the sort of notion that Romney's moving to the middle. He's changing from his primary behavior to his general election behavior. Doesn't our two-party system pretty much dictate that if you want to be a successful presidential candidate, especially as a challenger, that's what you do?
Yes, although no candidate in recent history has moved as many times from the right to the left to the center to the right to the center than has Governor Romney. I mean, it's been fascinating to watch, particularly on sort of domestic issues. Let's put the foreign policy aside, because in there, he spent most of 2 hours agreeing with President Obama, which, by the way, if you go back to foreign policy debates for many years, they've been probably the exact same meme, which is, wow, they agree with each other a lot. On the domestic front, whether it's Medicaid, What this week's shift has been around other issues, but it's just amazing to watch because I don't know which policy that Governor Romney is adhering to today. And I think it's actually a really interesting strategy because it leaves the Obama campaign sort of off balance because they don't know what to attack, because if they attack it, it'll just go, that's not what I meant anyway. And it's fascinating to watch.
Which might suggest maybe attacking is not going to work and he needs to focus more on what he's been doing the past 48 hours or so, which is being more explicit about what his future mm-hmm. agenda is.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a desire to know what could happen in the next 4 years. I think there are some unanswered questions out there that are 800-pound elephants in the room, and I don't see journalists raising them. I don't see voters raising them. So what happens if, for example, we reelect President Obama and he comes back and works with what is essentially a lame duck and absolutely recalcitrant Congress? What happens if we elect a President Romney and he comes back to work with what will essentially be a lame duck and a recalcitrant in a totally different way Congress? Nobody's nailing those two guys on what I think is really the central problem that's going to face them.
Yeah, one other theme that I thought emerged from the media reports and the pundits after this last debate was, who is the real Mitt Romney? And I'm really wondering if we can discern that. I mean, of course, on the left, the perception is the real Romney is this guy who's married to the Tea Party all of a sudden. On the right, maybe it's, well, he might be that, but he also might be this fellow who really, as he was in governor in Massachusetts, much more of a middle-of-the-road guy. How do we know, and who's going to be the real Romney if he emerges as the president?
We don't, and I think it's fascinating. I mean, it's the era in which we live, I think, in which perhaps a majority of voters will vote for a candidate who has been quite upfront about the fact that he is not going to explain to them what he will do with the budget, that he's not going to explain in any clear way what he plans to do as far as taxation is concerned, that he will not come clean with them as to what he's going to do with Medicare, and they're generally fine with that.
Well, which you could argue is fairly savvy tactics, too, waiting to see whether he'll have a Republican Senate as well as a House or, you know, what the lay of the land is going to be. Yeah, media performance again, Lee. We had this interesting point in the debate where President Obama explicitly denied a New York Times story that said that the White House was talking to Iran about the potential of negotiations over Iran's nuclear policy. I mean, he denied it again when asked about it after the debate, but it also seemed during the debate he was sort of suggesting that Romney ought to get on board with this idea of talking to the Iranians. What do we make of that?
I think we make of it that there are negotiations going on behind the scenes, that they're probably pretty deep into it, that it's not just with Iran, but it's with a number of our partners in whatever sort of sanctions that we're doing. This was a message, the story on the front page of the New York Times is a message as much to Iran as it is to the American public. And I think this is one of those times in the debate where the president is not just talking to the voters. There are lots and lots of other people watching, and I think these were times. I mean, what I noticed is he said the story in the New York Times is wrong, and not more than 5 minutes later, he used the word bilateral right. negotiations. And I thought, okie dokie then, we're sending a signal here, but it's not intended for me.
So wouldn't it have, I mean, if he didn't have all these other audiences to cater to, Charles, wouldn't it have made sense for him to tell the voters, I've been saying our strategy in Iran is working despite what Mitt Romney says. Here's proof of it. Why not say that we're about to negotiate with the Iranians? Or does he have to also say, you know, I've got to put on my commander-in-chief hat, I can't violate intelligence? I mean, why not say this?
I think that's a major part of it, is if it's an ongoing, incredibly delicate negotiation process, what you don't want to do is inject partisan politics into that on the eve of an election, because all of a sudden people will start saying incredibly irresponsible things right and left, and the Iranians will walk away, and that chance is gone.
And the reason he wants Romney to come on board is to send a signal that it doesn't matter who you're going to deal with in the White House, you're going to get the same set of alternatives essentially facing you. The players may change, but the geopolitics won't.
Let's focus for a moment on the moderator, because in each one of these debates, there's been some critique, whether it was Jim Lehrer not having any control, Martha Raddatz, was she being too tough, Candy Crowley, was she siding with the president in her immediate fact check. Well, how about Bob Schieffer? I mean, he clearly let them talk. He kept them, you know, pretty much even on time, but he was not interjecting himself to do follow-up questions or really dig too deeply, I didn't think. Good performance? Bad performance? Was he doing what moderators should do in this situation?
Well, I have a huge critique of what he did that begins with the set of questions that he selected, which were announced in advance. And my critique is that he let the campaigns dictate to him what parts of world affairs he was going to ask about. So, for example, we had no questions about Africa. We had no questions about Latin America. We had no questions about South America. We had no questions about Russia, let alone Mexico or Canada or Europe, for crying out loud. So he left off huge portions of the planet. And I think that that was because he was, as a journalist, he did what I think journalists should never do, which is let the campaign tell you what it is that you're going to ask about. So right from the get-go, I was pretty much honked at what he did.
Or was he letting the public or conventional wisdom dictate what questions he asked, because most people don't care about foreign policy debates to begin with, and they probably don't care about those parts of the world as much as they care about the Middle East especially, or China?
Maybe, although it'd be really interesting to have a discussion about Mexico, for example. Yeah. I mean, that would have been really interesting. I thought overall, beyond the questions themselves, as a moderator, I thought he did a good job. I mean, I always think the moderator in a foreign policy debate ought to be more of a sort of a referee. You know, you call the personal fouls, but otherwise you kind of stay out of the way and let them talk, because it's those longer expository treatments of subjects in which you learn a great deal in a foreign policy debate. Yeah.
The only goof he made, and he's not the first journalist to do it, first one in a debate maybe, but first one to have a chance to do it in a debate, he referred to Obama bin Laden instead of Osama bin Laden. I think we'll just have to forgive him for that one. Well, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp isn't the only media company on the other side of the pond that's courting disaster for shoddy journalistic practices. The BBC is taking it on the chin, and deservedly so, I think we'd all agree, for its handling of news that one of its longtime presenters, Jimmy Savile, sexually harassed young women on his shows. Last fall, the Beeb's Newsnight program was slated to air an investigative piece on Savile, but canceled. Instead, the British broadcaster aired glowing retrospectives of the now-dead host. Well, a few weeks back, the commercial news channel ITV exposed what some say is a cover-up. And this Monday, the BBC documentary program Panorama weighed in with its own investigation.
The affair has claimed its first casualty, with Newsnight editor Peter Rippon stepping aside while investigations continue. A BBC statement says his blog explaining his decision to junk an investigation into Savile was inaccurate or incomplete. For example, the article claimed there was no evidence against the BBC when the program had been told of abusive conduct on BBC premises. The latest twist comes on the day a Panorama documentary reveals the impact shelving the programme had on one of the women who'd been interviewed by Newsnight.
For all that stress, that's what made me angry. The fact that I'd gone through all that stress when I really needed to concentrate on getting well.
The journalists who worked on the original Savile story have expressed dismay with the network's decision to scuttle the Newsnight piece last fall, and now the BBC acknowledges it's investigating claims that Savile wasn't the only guilty party, that up to 10 past and present employees may have engaged in sexual abuse and harassment. Lee, how big a blow is this to the BBC?
I think this is substantial. I think it is their equivalent of the phone hacking scandal, and let me briefly say why. One, it clearly doesn't involve just a single person. It involves lots of employees at the BBC. The second, like phone hacking, is that this didn't occur over a period of a week or a few days. This occurred over decades. Mm-hmm. And third, it occurred on their premises. The thing that I keep expecting to see used as a parallel is, to me, this is much more like the Jerry Sandusky scandal for Penn State. And I think if that parallel holds, it would be very hard to coherently argue that Penn State as an institution hasn't taken a set of pretty severe blows. And I expect the same at the Beeb, quite frankly.
There's some quibbling, Charles, and both you and Lee have spent some time in Great Britain and monitoring the media when you were there with some of our students. There's some quibbling about the word cover-up. Is that too strong a word in this situation from what we've heard so far?
I don't think we know just yet. However, all signs point ominously toward moving in that direction. In fact, it looks very Sandusky-like, in that you had a charitable front used to lure children. And the more I read, the more disgusted I am. In fact, I mean, I don't think we're anywhere near the end of this story. It's taken the BBC a long time, way too long in this instance, to start airing its own dirty laundry. But once they start, watch out, because for the next couple of weeks, you're going to see a flood of reporting come out. Because unlike Sandusky and Penn State, they have already overcome the sort of let's protect our own impulse. And I think they've beaten that back.
I mean, clearly, Lee, the Panorama documentary show that aired this week, they pulled no punches. I mean, they were really going after the BBC and the other program that was canceled. Is that going to be enough to restore their reputation if they continue to do this type of really tough internal journalism?
I don't think so. And I think rightly or wrongly, we tend to, once a taint like this happens, you sort of want to go, okay, well, let's just cut it all out. I think the difference also that it's hard to know until you've lived there is that the BBC gets a lot of tax money, an awful lot of tax money. And Britain, just like every other place in Europe, is at a place where the government is trying to cut back. They're trying to do austerity. And so here you've got an institution that, at least on this level of control of its personnel on clearly criminal behavior, doesn't seem to have done what it needs to do. And so their chances of losing income, I think, are real.
Well, back here in the U.S., a news organization is also trying to dig itself out of a deep hole, totally different circumstances, but Newsweek magazine announced this week that it was going to stop publishing a print edition at the end of this year. This comes after a rapid decline in readership, ad revenues, and some would even say relevance. We all remember the Washington Post company sold Newsweek a couple of years ago for $1. The guy who bought the company died. IAC, which is now the owner, is also the folks behind the Home Shopping Network. They picked it up. They merged it with Tina Brown's online news site, The Daily Beast. And despite all those controversial covers that we've talked about on this show over the past several months designed to draw in readers, I don't know. It looks to me like maybe the magazine that so many of us counted on for decades could be on the verge of disappearing. What do you think, Charles?
It'll at least disappear into the digital space and become a digital brand. I mean, I don't know, 50 years ago, a lot of people got Life and Look and the Saturday Evening Post. Maybe that was more than 50 years ago now. Well, no, it was about 50, 60 years ago. And I guarantee you could transport yourself in the time machine back and talk to some journalism professors at the University of Missouri School of Journalism in 1956 and say, can you imagine Look, Life, and the Saturday Evening Post going away? And they would go, never. Not in 1,000 years. Right. Things change. Distribution models rot and die. And evolution, while incredibly painful in this case, was long overdue. I mean, if you look at from a fiscal standpoint only, those news magazines had been atrophying for more than a decade.
Well, and looking at the picture beyond Newsweek, Lee, the New York Observer asks in a headline this week, is the second wave of media winter on the way? What do you think?
I don't know if it's on the way, and I don't know that I would necessarily call it media winter, but I think this is the second or third or whatever wave, if you will, of when we say, okay, this fiscal model isn't working anymore. In addition, I think Newsweek has had content issues for a very long time. So you've got a fiscal problem, you've got a content problem, and meanwhile, you've got an audience that is if Mitt Romney flip-flops, the audience is just swimming in a pool of nothing but flip-flops. And people don't know whether they're going to get their news. We don't even know what's become habituated right now.
Well, some traditionally print journalism organizations have pointed to what they hope is a solution, which is the tablet. People are buying lots and lots of iPads, for example. The new iPad Mini was announced yesterday. Microsoft is coming out with its Surface tablet day after tomorrow. Charles, could tablets be the savior for, quote, print journalism?
No. I mean, but I think they offer one of the solutions. I think we've talked about this many times, and I sort of stick with my cowardly approach to answering that question, which is there's not one solution. There are many solutions. And I think tablets might be a partial solution if they can drive the price point way down. Microsoft Surface comes out of the gate at what? $499 to $699.
Same price as iPad, basically.
Yes. And I'm like, wow, that's a real differentiator. Thanks, Microsoft. What we need is something functional at a model where news companies can literally give them to subscribers, and then you'll begin to see something. I think.
As a little bit of transparency, I should say that RJI and the Futures Lab, which I run, are in a deal with Microsoft to test the new Surface tablet, some of their Windows 8 devices. We have very close relationships with Apple, but I think the jury is still out. But we have seen that people who consume content on tablets consume more news, they spend more time with the news and the advertising. So we'll see if that leads to anything. Well, let's move on to some lighter fare. Between the second and third presidential debates, President Obama and Mitt Romney got to crack wise at the Al Smith charity dinner in New York. You've probably heard some of their better jokes already, and if not, both speeches are on our blog. But I thought we'd take a moment to hear what they had to say about the media. President Obama took a light jab at his MSNBC heartthrob.
I particularly want to apologize to Chris Matthews. 4 years ago, I gave him a thrill up his leg. This time around, I gave him a stroke.
Well, it was Mitt Romney who used humor to offer the more sustained critique of media performance.
Now, I never suggest that the press is biased. I recognize they have their job to do, and I have my job to do. My job is to lay out a positive vision for the future of the country, and their job is to make sure no one else finds out about it. Let's just say that some in the media have a certain way of looking at things. When suddenly I pulled ahead in some of the major polls, what was the headline? Polls show Obama leading from behind. And I've already seen early reports from tonight's dinner. Headline, Obama embraced by Catholics. Romney dines with rich people.
Well, there's often more than a bit of truth in humor and sarcasm, as we regularly point out, Lee, when we praise Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. Well, how about Romney?
I think in some ways he did a good job, although I have to say that this is one of those ones where, you know, he talks about the polls when he's leading. He doesn't talk about all the critiquing and everything else that happened on Fox and with a lot of other people when he was behind, about how biased and ill done the polls were. So, that's what it's for, and it's good for everybody to have that take on it, if you will.
And Charles, the media dutifully covered the jokes at the Al Smith dinner, nice kicker material, but then right back to the debate war.
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe a little more humor sometimes, even in our news coverage, might be a little bit of help whenever we're in this kind of a campaign. Well, while we're talking of humor, an interesting and maybe even disturbing note from the world of comic books. In the latest edition of the Superman series, we learn that Clark Kent, his mild-mannered alter ego, is quitting his job at the Daily Planet. He says he's tired of working for a corporate conglomerate. The Daily Planet is now owned by Galaxy Broadcasting, that focuses more on celebrity and entertainment than news. Gee, where have we heard that before? And according to the comic book's writer, Clark Kent may decide that he's going to start his own Huffington Post or Drudge Report. We'll see how that plays out. But that really says something about the media environment when even in comic books are talking about it. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Our technical tandem is director Travis McMillan with the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and this week audio engineer Kyle Felling with KBIA. Go to our blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org for more background on today's topics or to see and hear the show again. We welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions via the blog or by email at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday as we fight for truth, justice, and the American way on another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.